This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I appreciate it. Can you all hear me okay? Is this okay? Awesome. Great. So thank you for that introduction, and I appreciate the invitation. I'm grateful for Mona reaching out and inviting me to be here with you all this morning. And I also appreciate you all indulging me as I present some of my scholarship with you. And I'll start actually in the theoretical area and then move into some of the practice of ministry, some of the programs that I coordinate. I'll show a video at the very end. But, you know, I really want to highlight the work of Latinas in theological education and what it means to pull from or draw from other wells of wisdom, you know, that maybe are not considered part of the canon of knowledge, right? That that we draw from to think about theology. So that's how I frame my work, really. So I will read from my manuscript, and then I'll open it up for questions after I present, if that is okay with you all. Yes. Okay. Excellent. So my argument is that too much of modern Christian theology and practice is shaped by a narrow definition of religion framed within a Eurocentric epistemology. And Eurocentrism advances an exclusionary and hierarchical framework that positions Europe and its epistemologies or ways of knowing and perceiving the world as universal and objective truths, which contributes to the narrowing of the boundaries set for the definition of religion, and specifically for defining Christian religious faith, formation, and practice. Additionally, some discourses of scientific discoveries advanced during the Enlightenment period proposed developmental theories that connected religious adherence to human development and relegated embodied religious practices to the category of primitive religions, and therefore lower in the developmental stage, as opposed to religious practices that were tied to the written word, or more aesthetically pious religious practices. So decolonial theorists reject the universality of Eurocentrism. In a recent article referring to ongoing forms of emergent learnings and unlearnings about coloniality's operations, resistance, political solidarity, alliance, fissures, and struggles, the author, Catherine Walsh, asks questions that challenge and inspire my own positioning as a practical theologian and religious education. And these are some of the questions that she asks. She asks us to think about how to struggle against, and possibly more crucially, how to create and construct. She asks, how to create and construct, and how do we plant and cultivate possibilities of a decolonial for? So rather than thinking about what we stand against, also thinking about what we stand for. So what new seeds must we plant? What senses should we develop? In what direction do we turn for a renewed horizon of hope and thought? And about what are these to be the concrete practices that we then lean into? These questions are at the core of why a reframing of religious education, in my opinion, is needed. My scholarship engages a decolonial approach to research that nuances the insider-outsider dichotomy of the researcher and the research site, and engages participatory action research methodologies in addition to ethnographic tools. So some of my dissertation work was to really engage the communities that I was working with. I was a part of those communities. I was a leader in those communities. So how do we blur these lines of being an insider, outsider, where we're not researchers that do fly-by research and then we leave. We are accountable to these communities because we are a part of these communities. So as an educator, I work towards a reframing of religious education that recognizes and values communities that have been subjugated, marginalized, and far too often rendered invisible. I highlight the work of one specific faith program, first because it is the program that I am most familiar with and the program that I've been invested in for the last 15 years. And second, because it spotlights the need to contextualize and localize decolonial struggles. So a decolonial reframing for religious education is going to look different depending on the communities of faith, because contextualization matters. So this is very particular to the ministry that I do. And it's not my, you know, the whole decolonial concept is that we don't universalize the learnings that we draw from, but that they inform other communities to think about, you know, how they do their own ministry work. So how then do Christian scholars and practitioners enact a stand that chooses a decolonial for? Working to recognize and value plurality and various forms of knowledge, ways of being in the world, and spiritual practices that inform our curriculum, our programs, our institutions, our denominations, our places of worship. What practices resist epistemic and spiritual genocide? How do we construct and cultivate the possibilities of a decolonial horizon that is here, but not yet? How do we lay the foundation for new forms of religious and spiritual formation? So in order to detangle a Euro-descended Christian hegemony from our modern practices of religious and spiritual formation, it's absolutely necessary for scholars in religious education to engage decolonial and anti-colonial projects and theories. Scholars must begin to imagine what it means to participate in and practice a decolonial reframing of religious education for the 21st century. So, what is the purpose of religious education in our diverse, pluriversal, and globalized world? Historically, religious education in the United States of America has been framed within a particular expression of Christianity that was intertwined with the imperialist expansion of Europe to the Americas and the Caribbean. Given this history of religious education, how can a decolonial lens help us to reclaim, to restore, retell, and reframe our Christian stories? To lean into the diversity of spiritual stories, practices, and knowledge systems of minoritized and subjugated communities in the U.S. Who gets to reframe religious education? What role do churches and institutions of theological education play in this reframing process? How should communities of faith participate? I think that all theologies and religious practices are contextual in that they encompass our desires and our aspirations to relate to and understand the divine through our complex and intertwined human experiences. Theologian Sally Brown asserts that practical theology is a thoroughly contextual inquiry that must account for an array of historical, social, economic, and political factors that shape human action and actors. And she quotes, "If this is the case, then theologians, practitioners, and scholars of religion cannot ignore the impact of the colonial encounter in shaping our modern religious cosmologies and practices." So, we must also acknowledge the ethical components of our religious inquiry for our individual and communal life together. Thus, religious educators or religious leaders and scholars must account for the experience and epistemologies of excluded and marginalized communities. As a religious educator and practical theologian committed to the process of decolonization, I think that it's vital for faith communities of the dominant culture to stand against all forms of oppression and marginalization and to participate in solidarity projects with communities at the margins that are working to reclaim and reimagine new ways of being and relating to each other and to the divine. This requires an epistemological shift that values knowledge systems and spiritual practices emerging from other sensibilities beyond the rationalism of European enlightenment. This is not to discard all European thought, rather it is an effort to problematize and expand the canon of what is considered legitimate knowledge and legitimate religious practice against the hegemonic belief that Europe is the sole master of both. Decolonization is the work of delinking from Eurocentrism. So I ask the question, why engage an anti-colonial Latina feminist praxis? Because of this delinking need. So a concept, Eurocentrism is a concept that is characterized by a meta-narrative. And a universalizing epistemology that places Europe and its history at the center and the culmination of world history. Decolonization is a political and material and epistemic process that aims to detangle nation states and its subjects from the matrices of power that are enacted or have been enacted through a legacy of colonization. Therefore, a decolonial epistemology assumes a permanent dialogue between pluriversal cosmologies and ecologies of knowledge, including partial and universal and unfinished forms of knowledge. So it's a way of engaging and expanding different forms of knowledge that have not been considered legitimate forms of knowledge in the past. It takes a stance against all forms of violence enacted by colonial and patriarchal structures, especially violence perpetrated against women and children, non-binary and trans bodies. Methodologically, it engages a collective construction of knowledge. So in my scholarship, I argue for an anti-colonial Latina feminist praxis, which aims to establish a stance that works alongside the process of decolonization and centers the practices and strategies of resistance forms, resistance from the specific locations of Latinx communities. So really taking a serious look at what Latino, Latina communities are doing, and more precisely from the experiences and practices of women, drawing from the work of Virginia Vargas Valente, who argues that critical theories always have practices behind them, or in other words, concrete practice has a concrete theory that emerges. She cites the work of Boaventura de Sosa Santos, who reminds us that recovering practices means recovering theoretical frameworks, opening channels through which social transformation can flow. And so I draw from the deep wells of wisdom of Latin American and US Latina, Latine, and queer feminist scholars who enact processes of interchanging contextual wisdoms that are oriented towards achieving just alternatives on the basis of diverse sources and currents. And so I propose that centering the voices, practices, and experiences of Latinas and the commitments that they have to their families, their neighborhoods, their faith communities, and valuing their inter and intrapersonal relationships, uncovering the unique epistemological frameworks that emanate from these concrete experiences, engenders new paradigms for faith formation. It engenders new forms of of doing our faith practices. In general, these practices are emancipatory, and they give voice to persons that have not had voice in the past. Furthermore, I posit an anti-colonial Latina feminist praxis as a necessary framework in a diverse ecology of decolonizing processes within traditional frameworks of religious education in an effort to move faith communities towards re-existence and world building otherwise, different than what we've done in the past. In response, practices of resistance emerged in all areas of everyday life. However, the practices and theories of resistance enacted by Latinas are rarely acknowledged or documented within and outside religious institutions. So one of the things I argue too is that because women have been on the ground doing ministry work, have not been writing much, have not often been in roles of leadership, we don't know the practices that they are enacting. But that maybe there are some other sites that can help us kind of engage those practices. Maybe social media is one of those places. Maybe they're communicating more through social media. So it's just a thought that we need to explore various non-institutional sites of knowledge. Additionally, locations where theology from the Hispanic Latinx perspective is often constructed are spaces dominated by male voices and perspectives. So to expand the framework of religious education, I draw from Latina feminist scholarship to help read and reveal the practices of resistance and new creation enacted by Latinas in leadership, specifically from a Protestant aesthetic. I think there's a lot written from the Catholic perspective, but there isn't a lot written about Latinas doing ministry from the Protestant perspective. So central to this praxis are pluriversal ecologies of knowledge, especially indigenous and feminist ways of knowing and centering the voices of youth, more importantly. So I want to situate my own ministry and the work that I do with the Hispanic Youth Leadership Academy. And so I want to share a little bit about that, that program. The Hispanic Youth Leadership Academy is an initiative that emerged as a response to the Latinx leadership gap that existed in a particular time here in the Southwest, actually. But it also became a way of resisting hegemonic frameworks and narratives that erased BIPOC ways of knowing, Black, Indigenous, people of color ways of knowing, being and practicing in their faith communities. So for over 20 years, the Hispanic Youth Leadership Academy has supported high school and college youth and young adults as they explore their vocation, their strengthen them their faith, and help them to find ways to serve within their churches and their communities. HILA hosts a number of summer leadership development programs for Latinx youth and college students across the United States, as well as abroad. And this initiative, organized by the United Methodist Church back in 2003, has recently been supported by the Episcopal Church through a grant by the Trinity Church in 2021. And it's designed to empower young Latinx leaders by deepening their faith, enhancing their educational pursuits, and strengthening their leadership skills within their churches and communities. I have been a mentor with this program since 2006, and I'm now a board member of the organization. And in 2006, when I first started, a small group of UMC Latinx leaders and seminarians were invited to Perkins School of Theology, just up the road, at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas, to brainstorm on strategies that could help develop leadership and faith formation initiatives from within the UMC Latinx faith community. When I started this work, it became apparent to me that the leadership of Latinas in the HILA program played a central role in the decolonial imaginary and pedagogical practices that I observed in my many years of participation in this initiative. So that is why I wanted to focus my research specifically on this program. And I center the ministry of Latinas and the voices and experiences of the youth and young adults that that we minister alongside with. I especially, for this talk, want to highlight the ministry of my colleague and co-conspirator, Reverend Dr. Cristian de la Rosa. She's the Associate Dean for Students and Community Life and an assistant professor at Boston University School of Theology. And so a few key components that are central to the practices used by the HILA program include intergenerational mentoring, peer learning, accompaniment pedagogies, and full inclusion of youth and young adults in the decision-making process. So as well as including them in the governmental and operational structures of the program. Cristian de la Rosa, and as the National Director of the Hispanic Youth Leadership Academy, has been instrumental in developing these methodologies and practices as core values of the work that HILA does. She notes that the mentors working with underrepresented minorities, especially Latine youth, must contend with complex contextual realities rooted in a history of a violent conquest of the Americas and the imperialist imposition of Christianity through processes of colonization. The themes of disentangling Christian hegemony and Christianity of and coloniality of power from these spiritual practices and communal commitments presents prominently in the curriculum and conversations during HILA workshops. So we have conversations on what does it mean to retrieve ancestral practices, ancestral spiritual practices. HILA engages a leadership and formation model that uses scaffolding learning through peer-to-peer and mentor-mentee accompaniment. Scaffolding is a term used in education to describe how students are supported by educators and/or mentors as they learn new information or acquire new skills. It often involves educators modeling the new knowledge, followed by facilitating individual and community practices of how to engage and apply this new knowledge. And finally, the educator steps back so that the student can practice the new concepts or skills. And so this is very much what we do with the Hispanic Youth Leadership Academy. The youth participate for the summer programs. They do 3 consecutive years of the high school program. And then once they graduate, we invite them to come back and be leaders for that program. So once they go off to college, they come back and they do work with the high school students. And then the same is true for those who graduate from the college component and go on to do seminary work. They come back and they are leaders for the college students. And then we invite them to be to really be a part of the decision-making processes of how we expand the program or how the program is going to continue, what themes and topics we engage, who we partner with, all of that. The youth are part of that process. So Professor de la Rosa explains that the accompaniment model as a mentoring within faith-based leadership formation initiatives for youth and Latinx leaders is vital. They need to have an opportunity to practice their leadership. So the unique accompaniment methodology that is explicitly named in this program centers accompaniment as a prolonged commitment across academic and personal life milestones through high school, college, graduate school, and then many of them through their first appointment in a church, so through their pastoral ministry. So it's holistic and it's intergenerational. And so I want to show a video of some interviews with the students and to as they share a little bit about how the program has impacted them. And then after that, I can open it up for questions.
My name is Andres De Arco, and welcome to HILA. The Hispanic Youth Leadership Academy is a coalition of United Methodist youth and young adult student leaders. Our mission is to discern our call to ministry through the pursuit of higher education, awareness of social issues, spiritual and mental growth. We develop our leadership skills as we discover our passion through practice within the church and our individual communities. We unite together in solidarity through our common Latinx experience and are committed to help the pueblo Latino, regardless of legal status, in order to transform the world.
Means a second family for sure. I was very privileged and honored to be able to be a part of this family and being able to have a platform in which I have a voice in. It inspired me a lot, and I know it inspired a lot of my peers who look just like me to have an impact in our communities, in our churches, in our families, wherever we may go. HILA has cultivated the minds of many youth, and I just want to take the time to thank Dr. De La Rosa, Patricia, and everybody else who made HILA possible. You guys are awesome. As you guys can see, I'm very proud to be part of the alumni. God bless.
Christian De La Rosa, National Coordinator for HILA. The need for the Hispanic Youth Leadership Academy, HILA, was conceived by Bishop Minerva Carcaño when she was a director of the Mexican American program at Perkins School of Theology. She secured a grant from the National Plan on Hispanic Ministries, and I was invited to serve as a consultant to implement this leadership initiative by Reverend Jimmy Trevino Tedley in 2004. We had the largest HILA groups of college and high school students at Perkins. However, in 2012, all of the youth initiatives there were merged, and HILA was not able to continue. Marcha was meeting at Boston University School of Theology for its annual convocation in 2013. So the national leadership team of HILA requested a meeting with Dean Mary Elizabeth Moore and Dean Pamela Lightsey to ask about the support that Boston University School of Theology could provide for the continuation of HILA. This request was welcomed, and the national coordination of HILA became part of my new faculty position at Boston University School of Theology. We continue to have high school sessions and college sessions at Boston University, also a college session at Garrett and a session of HILA High School at Adrian College. We are thankful for the support of the United Methodist Church from the beginning, the General Board of Higher Education and Ministry, the General Board of Church and Society, and the General Board of Discipleship have been key in supporting this leadership formation initiative, reaching between 90 to 120 Latinx United Methodist students every year. Key dates to celebrate is that in 2014, we had the 10th anniversary of HILA. In 2018, we had the 15th anniversary, which was a great quinceañera celebration. And we're looking forward to the 20th anniversary celebration.
HILA has a 17-year history that has developed into becoming one of the pioneering institutions for the development of Latinx leadership, both within the church and in local communities. HILA is a leadership program that dedicates itself to the formation of young leaders, both within the life of the church and within one's own community. It's a place where Latinx youth and young adults engage in conversation and action to face the obstacles in our community.
HILA means a place where you have been learning not only how to be a good leader, but also how can I use my knowledge to help the world to become a better place. Hyla gave me the opportunity to know my vocation, recognize what I was meant to be in the world, and what my task is in my community.
Hola, hello, my name is Gabriela Flores, and to me, Hyla means a community of faith that encourages, empowers, and guides young people like me to become better leaders in their churches and society by following whatever God is calling you to do.
And that's our mission, to bridge the gap by providing unique opportunities for our participants to engage in matters of social justice and faith-based learning. Through this model, we have seen several of our alumni accomplish great feats. Some of our leaders include Delia Ramirez, who was the first Guatemalan American elected to Congress, Emma Escobar, who was Director of Hispanic Ministries in Baltimore Washington Conference, and Juan Llana, entrepreneur and business leader at Vitol.
My name is Pedro, and I'm a rare individual in the United Methodist Church. I'm a young Hispanic who is a candidate for ordained ministry. Though we are small in numbers, many of my Hispanic and or Latino and Latina peers and I credit our interest in leadership and service to the Hispanic Youth Leadership Academy, known as HILA, and its college component, Raíces Latinas. Administered through Boston University School of Theology, HILA is a network of dedicated mentors and students who lend their passion to developing a new generation of United Methodist leadership that is reflective of our changing demographics. With very little resources, no official staff, countless volunteer hours, and a passion for the church, HILA is graduating some of the most valued young leaders in our churches and communities today.
One of the unique things about HILA is the diversity of applicants that come through our doors from across the world and who all leave with their own unique understanding of what it means to be HILA.
So I open it up for questions. Any questions or observations or, I'd like to have a conversation with you all about this work and,
Thank you so much. I'm excited or very interested and excited to hear about what are some of the practices that you have pulled from like the feminist Latina experience that.
Yeah, I think really it's about centering the voices of women that have been doing this work for a very long time and the relationships that they've developed. So, you know, often it's not like the leaders that are the pastoral leaders, it's often, you know, like, and I pull from you know some of the scholarship of abuelita theology. It's the grandmas and the aunts that have you know pushed young people to be to encourage them and to tell them you know you are doing great things and you are a sacred person. You know you're a sacred. You are somebody of sacred worth. And so just kind of highlighting those relationships. Yeah.
So I had a question as well, or just a thought. So in the work that you do in these communities, at what level is their awareness that they are articulating, you know, a new path forward, or they are bringing to light new spiritual practices? I was just really caught by a phrase that you use. I mean, it's a very generative space to be in. And so it just made me wonder how aware are folks that, you know, that they are engaged in this kind of work?
Yeah. I think the youth talk about, they share the fact that we open up the space to have conversations that they have not had, you know, in the church before. So conversations about, especially like, you know, some of the youth that come from Afro-descendant countries, they say, you know, what does it mean for us to be Black and Latino? We never talk about that in the church, right? We don't talk about our identity and our, you know, and then how that impacts us when we come here in the U.S., right? Like, so talking about identity in a different way. Talking about their, you know, the experiences that they have of, you know, they bring kind of like syncretic faith traditions, right? Some things that they don't necessarily talk about in the church. Like, what does it mean to be a person who practices, you know, in a United Methodist Church, but then, you know, also goes to a Catholic church for family members who have, you know, confirmations or baptisms or things like that. So just talking about, you know, the diversity of spiritual practices. Mm-hmm. And that is a legitimate way of being a person of faith.
Thank you. So I think this is real exciting. I'm very interested in it. I hear you talk of the Methodists and the Presbyterians and the Episcopalians.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in how we can all work together.
Yeah.
And I also wanted to know what's going on in Austin.
I'm new to the Austin area, so I've just been here for a year. I've been on faculty at Austin Presbyterian, and we had our first HILA program this summer. So I'm glad to say we're starting those partnerships here in Austin now. Some of the programming that we've done with Methodist and Episcopal youth has been very enriching for both groups. They always tell us how much they've learned about their own faith traditions by speaking with youth from another denomination that do things a little bit differently, and then they see, I didn't know that was something, you know, particular that we did as Episcopalians, and so learning in that way and sharing, you know, what the similarities are. How the communities are serving their, you know, the services that they provide to their communities and where they connect. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of enriching kind of connections that are being made.
One last comment. We just learned yesterday that Reverend Angela from this church has been selected as a suffragan bishop in West Texas, which is basically San Marcos South.
Yeah, I just heard. Yeah, right. That's great news.
Yeah, of course, includes San Antonio. News. That's where it's headquartered.
At the beginning of your talk, you were talking in more theoretical terms about the decolonization of religious practices. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you could give an example of that. I work best with examples.
Yeah. So I'm thinking about some of the embodied practices, right, of that we often limit. You know, why do we say that this is prayer, right? Or that this is prayer instead of this is prayer, right? Or dancing, you know, cumbia is a prayer. You know, like what kinds of other embodied practices can we draw from our ancestral practices, from our community practices that can also, you know, inform our spirituality? So that's some of the things that we also talk about with the youth, right? Why do we limit it to just this, right?
Yeah, I was interested in that too, because we think of the hierarchy. But it's much more than that.
Yes.
The things that you're talking about, you know, we're all familiar with that, of the hierarchy of a male-dominated church in Europe and other places. But it's way beyond that in terms of leadership. So I was interested in what you're saying and the work that you're doing. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to talk about the fact that we mentioned about working more closely with the Presbyterian Seminary and the the Seminary of the Southwest. So this is another good example of ways that we could work together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think also, you know, one of the things with working with Latina women is how do we tap into our own friendships, right? And how does that inform the way that we lead, right? So, you know, it isn't a competitive space where we are showcasing, you know, our expertise, but it's really collaborative and like how are we sharing it and mentoring and accompanying others to work alongside us rather than, you know, always taking the space where we are the ones who are giving voice to what we're doing, right? Sometimes it requires us taking a step back and letting others, you know, even in their own way, stumble through their own leadership, right?
Thanks very much. I want to be careful because I'm probably the most Anglo person in the room. It's interesting because I'm wondering about the colonization piece because Christianity has been so intertwined, not only with colonization, but even in the spread of Western Europe. You know, Christianity into Western Europe has been attached to those, you know, those metamorphoses, if you will. And, you know, and Christianity has changed through that process as well. And, you know, so, I mean, Christmas and Christmas trees is, you know, out of Germany, for example, right? And some of the things that we do in other trappings are from England. And then you look at Day of the Dead, for example, from Mexico, which is wonderful, right? And it is changing Christianity, certainly in the south of the U.S. and maybe arguably even north. So, you know, I just wondered if you could comment how you disentangle something that is centuries and centuries and centuries old.
Yeah, and I think one of the central arguments of kind of decolonial theories is to recognize that some of the practices within our churches have been have drawn from a particular kind of localized practice in Europe, right? From a very specific time and space, and those practices then were universalized, or at least projected as universal you know, Christian practices, but they were particular to a region, right? And so understanding that, and that Christianity you know, was practiced differently in other areas, but those practices were not universalized. And so kind of retrieving those practices and saying, you know, it's fine to pull from different ones. Christianity has done that over the centuries, right? There isn't one correct way to be Christian, right? As we know with, you know, the various denominations that we practice. Any other?
From the little bit that I know about Hyla during your lecture here and from my own experience, I mean, I think that awareness is great for everyone. It's great for the church. It's great for our community. It's great for academia, especially areas of academia that have been actually close-minded. So the academia, Eurocentric academia, is oftentimes close-minded to what is intelligence, what is real, what is what are meaningful contributions. And so the contributions of Afro-Latinos and Afro-Caribbeans and, you know, Mexican Norteños, Mexican-American, Central American, you know, they all of these regions and all of these peoples and all of these languages all do contribute to richness. And of those who are people of faith, they don't have, there's no trade-off. You don't have to, I mean, you know, back then during colonialism, it was, you know, there was, you know, destruction and you know, murder and unthinkable crimes, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, throughout time, there are opportunities for healing and reunification and mutual respect and protection of these indigenous peoples throughout the Amazon, throughout Central America, recognizing the contributions, the scientific contributions of the Aztecs, the Incas, and, you know, all of that. And we learn and we grow as much as we're willing to grow. And I think that it's, you know, it's a beautiful thing from my perspective that the bringing awareness to people who just don't know. And even, you know, people who are more Anglo like yourself and many others, obviously, growing in the Episcopal Church, it's a great opportunity for them to learn and to grow in their faith as these contributions of people who are going into professions, who are, you know, Hispanic youth, throughout the whole Hispanic diaspora. And I think that... you know, I think it's a rare opportunity, you know, if we're willing to give that. And people who are coming through these programs are feel the confidence and the motivation that their voices will be heard.
Yes. Well said. Thank you.
Yeah, that's probably a good note to close on. What do you think?
Thank you so much for your engagement and for indulging me in presenting my scholarship to you all. I really appreciate it. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at stdave.org and click on the podcast button.